Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you a recording of our plenary session on recipient perspectives on the new aid landscape from the 2015 Australasian Aid Conference. Presentations are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
My name is Anthea Mulacala. I'm with the Asia Foundation. I'm one of the co-conveners of the conference today. And I'm going to introduce the panel on recipient perspectives to the changing aid landscape. We're very excited about this panel. While there is an abundance of donor chatter and writing about new forms of development finance and a lot about new actors on the scene, we don't often hear from the recipient side and hear their perspective on how they're adjusting to or how they perceive this new landscape in their countries. And so today we're going to bring you that perspective from speakers who are working within partner governments. I have to say it's been extremely challenging to assemble this panel. We originally had a speaker, the central bank governor from Sri Lanka. And if you follow Sri Lanka, you know that there was a fairly dramatic election result a few weeks ago. And soon after, our speaker resigned as the central bank governor and consequently was unable to come. Also in Timor-Leste, you may know that the resignation of the prime minister was accepted. I think it was on Monday, officially announced. And so in that case as well, our original speaker was unable to come. So I'm extremely grateful to Mr. Heng from Cambodia for not being diverted from attending our conference by any political excitement in Cambodia. And also to Pepe, who joined the panel also at short notice and is presenting on Laos, and he gave an excellent presentation in the last session, so we're really appreciative that he's doing back-to-back presentations for us. And then lastly to Guta for making himself available at very short notice to join us from Timor-Leste and, you know, flew in on that long flight yesterday. But also I have to, on behalf of Guta's attendance as well, thanks to the Australian government for facilitating one of the quickest Australian visas imaginable. This panel and the next one build actually on two events that Gordon referred to them in his opening remarks, that we held in Cambodia last week and one in Timor-Leste this week, which discussed the changing aid landscape with national stakeholders in both countries. So I think some of the observations and the findings you'll hear today will come from the discussion that was had with a variety of national stakeholders. So first I'd like to introduce Mr. Chu Heng, who is the Director General for the Department of Policy and Development Assistance Coordination, Council of Development of Cambodia, the Royal Government of Cambodia. Mr. Heng has been with the Council for the Development of Cambodia, the CDC, since 2004 and became Director General, overseeing the Division of Policy and Development Assistance Coordination in 2014. And prior to that, he was appointed in 2007 as Assistant Vice Chair of the Supreme National Economic Council, which is an elite policy think tank attached to the Prime Minister's office. And it's a position he still serves until now. Mr. Heng.
Good afternoon. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to speak in this session on the issue of changing aid landscape seen from the perspective of partner country. And also it's based on the work that I've been conducting as part of my responsibility at the Council for the Development of Cambodia, of the government, Royal Government of Cambodia. So I think it is helpful to start off with the presentation of some basic facts about Cambodia, which is one of the small countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, with an area just think slightly over half of that of the state of Victoria here. We have a small population, close to one-fifth of the population is still below the poverty line. Real GDP growth average 7% per annum with the per capita of slightly more than 1,000. So in terms of HDI ranking, Cambodia ranks 136 out of 187 countries. Political system, we are a constitutional monarchy with parliamentary government. The economy is mainly agrarian and also relying on tourism and garment sectors. Cambodia is a post-conflict country. The conflict ended with the first democratic election under the auspice of the United Nations in 1993, and in which Australia also played a considerable part in the process. So an overview of development assistance Cambodia has received so far. So Cambodia has received a significant amount of external assistance. So in 2013, external assistance amounted to close to 1.5 billion. So representing a year-on-year increase of 11.4% per annum. Of the total amount, China accounted for 28%, followed by the Asian Development Bank, Japan, and as shown here, the breakdown of the shares of total assistance by donor countries. So this placed China as the single biggest assistance provider for Cambodia, followed by Japan. The figures in the last 10 years also show that the grants are relatively unchanged, while we observe an increasing trend of concessional loan, especially during the last 5 years. Loan exceeded grant for the first time in 2013. And this trend we expect to continue for years to come. Okay. So together, partners, countries, and agencies from the Asia Pacific account for more than half of the total assistance that Cambodia has received so far in the last year. Here, the first graph on the left shows the pattern of funding during the last three terms of the royal government. The period 1999 to 2003, 2004, 2008, and 2009, 2013. And 13, we observe an increasing trends from the period 1999 to the last mandate of the government, 2009-2013, an increase of around 80% per mandate. Funding to social and economic sectors during the last three terms of the government are relatively stable, counted respectively for the social sector, around 37-38%, while the economic sector was around 19-18%. But we observe a fourfold increase funding to the infrastructure sector during the last term of the government. while support to cross-cutting services decline. Of course, in nominal terms, the fund that went to support cross-cutting services is still big. But if we look at for the funding pattern by donor countries, we would see a shift away from support from the international organization, the European countries, and those from North America. And we see a growing partnership with countries in the Asia Pacific. In the last mandate of the government, 2009-2013, support from countries like China, South Korea, the Asian Development Bank, Australia included, accounted 42.4% of total external assistance, while support from IOs and from Europe and North America have steadily declined. This reflects in the increase in funding to the infrastructure sector, and also the upward trend of the loan concessional loans in the total amount of assistance that Cambodia has received over in the last several years. So we can say that the aid landscape is changing, and the surge in aid from China, of course, is one factor accounting for the change. And at the same time, we also have seen the proliferation of providers that are non-state in providing services in working in the at the community level in Cambodia. Also, philanthropic funds and vertical funds like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Global Funds, they also have growing activities and coverage. Also, new forms of cooperation like South-South and South-South cooperation and Triangular cooperation. So, if we compare the two charts here, we can observe that the increase in support from partners from the Asia Pacific is mainly accounted for by the surge in aid provided by China, as the second graph show. So, this is just part of the story. Cambodia has benefited a lot from receiving development assistance in the years. So, as a result, the royal government has been successful in maintaining growth for a sustained period of time, disrupted as the first figure shows, disrupted only in year 2009 as a result of the economic crisis 2008. This has enabled the government to expand its capacity, its budget capacity with regard to development spending. So we have seen an increase in capital spending compared to a recurrent budget over the years. And the government also has been able to attract private investment, foreign direct investment into the country. The share of FDI compared to the country's GDP is significant, and this shows Cambodia has been one of the destinations for foreign direct investment. And these have provided background as to how the government would position itself in this new and changing landscape. Is it aid at being at a critical low time in Cambodia? So This has been driven by several factors. First, there have been claims that Chinese aid has no string attached, China is not interested in policy conditions and conditionality. So these have, and indeed it has been confirmed in several studies, including the recent one conducted by ODI, which confirmed the role of Chinese aid in providing wide latitude for the Cambodian government in being assertive vis-a-vis the traditional donor community. The second factor is the feeling of aid fatigue in Cambodia. Probably Cambodia has received aid for a long time. And this has been also pointed out in an evaluation the Council for Development of Cambodia conducted in 2010 as to what extent aid has been effective in contributing to development in Cambodia. And we found out the element of fatigue, especially associated with the cost, the transaction cost imposed, related with coordinating with donor agencies, with coordinating the various projects, various modalities of aid provision. This has resulted in the government being less interested in coordination, in dialogue with the donor community. This has been reinforced by the disappointing progress not just in Cambodia but also globally in terms of implementing the commitments on aid effectiveness as agreed in the Paris Declaration 2005 and again in the Busan commitments in the Busan Partnership for Effective Development Cooperation. So this has reinforced a growing skepticism towards aid in the country. Another problem is a series of mismanagement or corruption issues in aid projects. High-profile cases in the World Bank-funded projects and recently in the Global Fund projects in Cambodia. And both parties, the government and donors, seems to be unable to settle this issue. So from another angle, there has been criticisms against aid in Cambodia, especially work by researchers and academics recently attacking the role of aid in Cambodia. And one of the most noted studies is by a Cambodian-born American researcher or professor who found that instead of promoting democracy, good governance, aid in Cambodia has actually worsened good governance. So aid has been a problem rather than a solution. And at the same time, Cambodia also has to see the prospect of revenues from the extractive industries like oil and gas. So these factors have bolstered the stance of the Cambodian government and also have made a lot of people, including the public, more skeptical about the benefits of aid in the country. So, Cambodia needs to adapt to the changing aid landscape. As the previous figure shows, development assistance still consists, is still a considerable part of the public finance for the country, especially financing for development. So the government for the medium to long term needs to address the pressing needs for sustaining growth, because Cambodian economy is narrowly based. The economy relies mainly on the agriculture sector. Industry, we rely mainly on the clothes and garment sector, garments, clothing. So there's an urgent need to diversify the economy, especially faced with intense competition from countries in the region. Now the government is embarking on program to modernize the economy, especially to transform from a low-skill economy to high-skill-based economy and knowledge-based economy. So, but in the mean, at the same time, the government also needs to address the issue of financing for development in the country. So, public finances in the country are still relatively weak. The budget is still small. Part of the spending, capital spending, still relies on external financing. FDI, despite growing amount, still are still not yet coordinated and strategically placed in the strategic areas. And there's a need to integrate and to link these different elements together so that we could have a coherent financing for development of the country. Finally, the Royal Government of Cambodia sees the changing aid landscape as an opportunity. We need to adapt and position the country so that we can make use of the coming scarce resources and the diversity of sources of funds. But of course, there are risks, especially risks associated with different donors, the risk of fragmentation and dilution, which already is happening on the ground. So now the situation is that in which a lot of donors are doing things which we don't have, the government doesn't have information. So then this has led to antipathy on the part of both of government. So this is an issue, the issue of coordination and dialogue needs to be addressed. And also there's a need for a coherent view of for the government on what constitutes development. So far, the Millennium Development Goals have provided framework, but it's not the whole story. The Royal Government of Cambodia has tended to emphasize growth at the expense of improvement on social indicators. So, in the post 2015 landscape, we need to be coherent as to what constitutes development. Growth is important, but it's not sufficient. We need to make improvement as to education, health, and especially environment. So there is a consensus on within the country on working towards an inclusive partnership with all partners, the traditional donor community, the emerging partners, the private sector, the non-government organization communities, and vertical funds and philanthropic funds. So in this new environment, business as usual is no longer possible, in which donors just come and provide funds without sharing information, without coordination, without consultation with government and with other actors is no longer possible. So this is all for my presentation, and I'm ready to get your question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Heng. We'll move to our next speaker. So our next speaker from Laos is Pantanuson Kenavon. We'll call him Pepe for short. And Pepe is a national technical advisor to the Department of International Cooperation with the Lao government, managing aid coordination and aid effectiveness in Laos. Pepe has just completed his PhD from the Crawford School of Public Policy. Congratulations. And his thesis looks at the Lao experience of development assistance in relation to three contemporary aid issues: the influence of aid on governance, the impact of the poverty reduction strategy, PRS, approach, and the influence of growing Chinese aid, which is what he spoke very interestingly about in the last session. I don't know how much longer you're going to be with us here at ANU. I imagine you'll be going back home soon, so we're really lucky that he's still here and he's able to make the presentation for us. Pepe.
Thank you. I don't have presentation. I'm just going to give very short talk about what it means, the new aid landscape for the Lao government. And before I do so, I sort of thank Antia for the introduction. And thanks to Women Policy Center and Crawford School, and particularly Stephen House, who is my supervisor, for the opportunity to talk about the new aid landscape in Laos. And my talk is based on my own experience working with United Nations in Laos and fighting for my own thesis about the politics of aid and the rise of Chinese aid to Laos, and my current appointment as introduced by Antia as a technical advisor to the National Aid Coordination Unit Department of International Cooperation in Laos. In the morning, as mentioned by Antia, I gave a presentation on one of the parallel sessions on aid, Chinese aid to Laos. So this afternoon, I'm going to give a talk to more generally about what does it mean, new aid landscape in the eyes of the Lao government. And of course, I talk about this in the lens of the aid coordination aspect. So my talk is going to focus on three key aspects. First, I will be talking about history of aid coordination in Laos. And second, I will highlight how aid coordination in Laos has been impacted by the rise of non-traditional donors or emerging donors, if you like. And the last part of my talk will address the challenges of the new aid scene in Laos and how the Lao government is responding to them. So first, before I talk about that three key aspects, let me give you a brief background for Laos. If you don't know about Laos, it's very small. It's actually a neighbor of Cambodia, 6 million people, and next to China. Experiencing fast growth and just crossed up over from being a low-income country to middle-income country in 2011. However, aid is still very important. It's about 7% of GDP at the moment, and the big donors are Japan, Australia, Germany, and now, of course, China. The figures about non-traditional donors are not available, but from my own calculation as part of my thesis, China is now the biggest donor in Laos. And then we also have other non-traditional donors in Laos as well, Vietnam and Thailand and India. And Laos has engaged in the economic reform and aid reform for the last few decades, and that's what my thesis is really about. And then in this, I'm going to look back over the whole aid period since 2000 and situate the rise of emerging donors in that context. So now my first question: how has aid coordination in Laos has changed over the last 15 years? The Lao government restructured its aid coordination called the roundtable process in 2000. It's now been held in the country, shared by the government, not by donors anymore. It used to be UNDP. Over the years, the interaction between the government of Laos and its donor community has become better organized. Now we have, at the policy level, one high-level meeting organized annually. And then there are currently 10 sector working groups with chair by the government, organized as often as needed. And then there are now provincial coordination units established to coordinate aid at the provincial level. For donor side, UNDP co-chairs the roundtable process. It works closely with other donors through quarterly informal donor meetings to have a common message and approaches to the development. And the government and donor community, traditional donor and non-traditional donors, Chinese, China, Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia, signed the Vientiane Declaration Country Action Plan in 2005. This is a country version of the Paris Declaration to enhance aid effectiveness in Laos. And every year, the Lao government carry out monitoring exercise, tracking the progress of the implementation of this country action plan. And also recently, the Lao government installed the aid management platform and then published the foreign aid report on the annual basis. So, and then still, the figures on non-traditional donors are not available. So now let me talk about how the process has been impacted by the rise of non-traditional donors. In fact, non-traditional donors, China, Vietnam, Thailand, and India now attend, and some of them becoming more active in the aid coordination meetings. There are increasing size of effective dialogue between the Lao government, traditional donor, and non-traditional donors. For example, China, Chinese ambassador, Vietnamese ambassador, Thai, and India ambassador attend quarterly informal donor meeting, which is chaired by the UN resident coordinator. And they also deliver joint message or common messages to the about the Lao development when they meet with the Prime Minister and the President of Laos last year after the roundtable meeting. So that's sort of a good sign that non-traditional donors and traditional donors and the government are working together. That said, for non-traditional donors, the relationships are mainly bilateral, and the Lao government liked non-traditional donors to participate more in the roundtable process, but then they're also keen for the traditional donors to cooperate more with the non-traditional donors. And the Lao government state clearly that the diverse partnership with both traditional donors and non-traditional donors have providing them more choices. I give this quote for my thesis. I did so in the morning as well. So this senior government official mentioned that Laos doesn't want to be a Chinese client state, but our strategy is to ensure that the rise of Chinese aid as it provides an alternative resource for the party. What will we do if there is no support for other resource tomorrow? I don't think it will happen. However, we need to have an alternative choice in case that we don't agree with the term and condition attached to aid provided by some other donors. So that's sort of the quote that Lao government mentioned during my interview for my thesis. And then we also see the rise of the South-South cooperation in Laos. For example, now there is an annual meeting between Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. They call it CLV, which is focused on the development and learn from each other about the development in general. And then for my working with UNDP and my thesis and also working with the government now, I can see that the government has become more assertive and take greater leadership in aid coordination. And two examples that I can give, now the government is setting the agenda for all of the meetings, and then they instruct their line ministries and other government agencies that all the meetings have to be conducted in Laos, where the English translation is provided. So that's sort of a sign that they are taking this aid coordination seriously. And so in summary, even though non-traditional donors are only partly integrated into the aid coordination process, this present empowered the government to demand more coordination from the traditional donors. From almost a year now, I work with the government of Laos. I would say with confidence that non-traditional donors have made the Paris Declaration more relevant for Laos, not less. So now let me talk about the challenges. And well, although there are lots of good things happening in Laos, not everything is working well. There are still many challenges, and then I'm just going to highlight three of them. First, As I mentioned, non-traditional donors still work largely in bilateral way. Although there is more coordination among them, but I think there's still a long way to go, and the government welcomed them to participate in the roundtable process. But we need to work harder to cooperate with non-traditional donors. And the second, traditional donors, although they have signed this Paris Declaration and then the localized version of that declaration, Vientiane Declaration, they all still want their own bilateral meeting and still just for inference. For example, not everyone is happy with that UNDP is co-chairing the round table process. And some donors indeed try to lobby the government for a change in that process. And another example that I also mentioned in this morning, that the problems that donor have to coordinate is assistant to the Laos system. Laos Legal Sector Master Plan, the government asked donors to coordinate the assistance, but this led to 2 years of infighting and donors struggle to agree on sort of issues such as consultancy fees and reporting requirements and use of country systems. So it took traditional donors 2 years to agree on that trust fund to help implementation of the Legal Sector Master Plan. And third, because of the Laos government has opened up more to donors, both traditional donors and non-traditional donors, and they are willing to share more documents with them, but then the process of consultation can be very time-consuming. For example, for our new five-year plan that we are working on at the moment, we are looking for result-based management framework. This is good, but sometimes we get so many comments from donors and so many separate comments, despite the fact that we ask UN resident coordinator to facilitate and coordinate comment, but then donors still prefer to send separate comments to the government, and then government officials feel overwhelmed, and in turn this make them reluctant to share document, and because of all the hassle involved. So I'm going to end my talk by saying that to answer what does the new aid landscape mean for the Laos government, well, on the positive side, it means that the Laos government is more empowered to take greater ownership of policy and aid management. And the government also appreciates having choices, both funding choices and policy choices. But the downside is that transaction costs are still high, and sometimes because more things are on the table for discussion, it is taking longer to get things done. It is definitely a problem for which can be resolved by donors, showing more discipline and coordination, and by the government itself, that's showing even more leadership and ownership. So that's sort of what it means to me. Okay. Yep.
Thank you very much, Pepe. Our last speaker is Guteriano Neves, Guta for short. And Guta is a researcher and analyst on political economy and is an advisor for the presidency of the Republic of Timor-Leste on macroeconomic and regional integration affairs. Guta graduated from the University of Hawaii and majored in political science and history. And last year, he was one of our Distinguished Asia Foundation Development Fellows. He completed the fellowship this year. He also has a history of working for a prominent NGO in Timor-Leste, as well as being a journalist for several.
Thank you for a kind introduction. And good afternoon, everybody here. As you know, Auntie just mentioned, I got a notification 2 days before today, so I didn't have a presentation. But I want to give a presentation that built up based on my previous work in NGO and also my current work in the president office, which some people would say that make contradiction because one is NGO, one is state. But in Timor, at one point on the aid issue, almost state institution and civil society come to an agreement. So I don't feel like making a contradictory statement here. I want to start by saying what I'm feeling. Dili has been in an anxious situation for almost 1 month.
due to the resignation of one of the most influential political figures. And on the way yesterday to here, it came out in the news that the new prime minister already appointed, the president has approved it. But also I'm excited when I got a notification, because this is my first time to Australia. But I am also kind of nervous standing around in the front of you, most of the people who have been knowing this issue more than I do. So as I'm talking about managing diversity, I'm also trying to manage my feeling. Which one? So let me start by saying that most of the issues that Timor-Leste has experienced are not different from what have been discussed by us two speakers before. So it makes my work easier. But to put it in the context, Timor-Leste, if some of you might be aware of, was in total destruction in 1999. It was what was later on proved to be systematic and structural violence campaign by the Indonesian military. So when in 1999, it was 80% of public infrastructure was destroyed, 80% of population was displaced, and almost all of the high-level government officials left the country because they were Indonesian, not Timorese. So we have to build that from that. And at that situation, aid played a key role to rebuild the country. Between 1999 up to 2005, aid made the state's existence was visible. There were several channels where the donors funded the programs. For example, they have a consolidated fund, which was administered by the UN. They have trust fund administered by the World Bank. They have direct budget support through the government, which was very small. And then some of the NGOs support through the NGOs funding. And the situation, most of the criticism is the same: lack of ownership, lack of consultation, lack of long-term vision. But just want to say that between the time, there are some calculations. It was hard to say how much money that spent because of the issue of lack of information at the time. So, but there's some calculation that around 10 to 12 billion were spent up to now. It's in terms of per capita, it's quite high, given that population was 1.1 million. The population. But some people say that every $10 that was spent, only $1 entered into the domestic economy. So people say that, well, it's spent on Timor, but not in Timor. So there is some criticism. But what I would like to focus on is what has been changed and what we are looking forward. The first is that there is an agreement, as I said before, about the various issues that I mentioned before. But the government also is taking more effort. The aid is changing because of various factors in Timor. One is the fact that the oil revenue has increased tremendously. So although in terms of nominal terms, the aid expenditure is still above 200 million, but because the government's budget is skyrocketed during the last 5 years, so in terms of percentage, the government the aid contribution to the public expenditure is around 10 to 12%. And it is expected that this year, up to next year, it will decrease significantly. Right now, the And the other factor is the fact that the global aid campaign on aid effectiveness has contributed to public perception and implementation of aid projects in Timor. And the government, Timor-Leste, is playing a leading role in groups G7 Plus, and the G7 Plus was established based on Dili Declaration in 2009. So the government is taking control over it. The another factor is the fact that the financial crisis that hit the European countries, developed countries, has impact on Timor. Portugal, which was the biggest trade development partners in Timor, is now changing. It's still the top eight, but it is its contribution has decreased tremendously. In fact, in a few years ago, we had the donors for the Portugal. We provided some support for the Portugal. another factor is that changing in the mindset and perception. In Timor, the concept of donor recipient was not pretty much used, at least in the official discussion. It's called development partners. So we have a kind of coordination meeting. We call it development partners meeting, which was built based on the Paris Declaration and Accra Action Plan. It was a mechanism where the donors and where the development partners sit together to see, to listen to the what the government priorities are and to see what are the gaps that they can step into. The another factor is that Timor-Leste now is not a pure recipient country anymore. The concept of recipient and donors is a very, my personal, it's a very critical concept because in my experience in dealing with the development partners, some donors think that the recipient are the sick man who needs remedy for the illness that they have. And without consultation or consideration to the history, to the culture, to the very existence. And it makes the so-called partnership is very hard. So instead of seeing donor recipient, we need to change this. And this has contributed. So Timor-Leste now is also contributor, not only by financial terms, but also by sharing its experiences to the world. Timor-Leste through G7 Plus, in fact, Timor-Leste is hosting the group of G7 Plus headquarters in Dili. I think it was the plan that the Secretary General of the G7 Plus would attend this meeting, but it was explained. And through this channel, Timor-Leste has been sharing its experience in various ways, in terms of reconciliation, in terms of moving from a post-conflict, being ruled by one of the most authoritarian regime in the world, to a country that is now pretty much a democratic country. We had election, we had parliament, we had flourishing civil society, free media. And also one of the experiences that is globally cited is the fact that we have a petroleum fund law, which is frequently cited as the best case. We can discuss about the economic consequences about it, but this is what globally acknowledged. So Timor-Leste has also been trying to increase its voices in international arena by sharing what the country has been going through. In terms of the contribution, right now Australia is the biggest donor. It contributes around 31 to 33% of the total development partners' financial support. And then the other change is that China is on the top eight donors, And if some of you happen to have been in Delhi, the most visible project would be China. Chinese aid, because it built three most important buildings in Timor-Leste, which is Presidential Palace, the one that I'm working in. Ministry of Foreign Affairs building, and then headquarters of Defense Force. And then the other donors are South Korea is getting there, and Timor-Leste is also thinking of, in fact, in this year, we already take a so-called concessional loan. In our previous discussion, we didn't consider concessional loan as the aid, because it is something that we pay. That is it. So with that, so the question might come after all of the criticizing, does Timor-Leste still needs aid? Well, it's a critical question. Further question would be, is aid only about the money? The fact that in the president's point of view and in our point of view, that aid is not only about the money. In fact, aid from Timor-Leste, at least what the president has been talking about, is that aid is a small part of the cooperation among nations and among states. So there are different kind of cooperation, partnership that the countries can explore. One is for sure Timor-Leste is a new country, 13 years being an independent, with the institution are still in a building process. So we are still lacking of a lot of experiences, a lot of knowledge. So in that sense, I think aid is a form of cooperation need to. But we also need to, for the donors country, partners country, need also to consider that working in a post-conflict country, in a newly independent country with new institutions, is not the same as working in an already developed institution. It poses different dynamics, poses different challenges, but also provides a lot of opportunity. Then in Timor, one thing that I can, investment in education is very, very important. For the Australian government, you might take it as a credit. In Timor, many of the young professionals who are working in the public institutions nowadays and are driving the change in Timor public institutions are people who studied in Australia from the Australian Development Scholarship. So investment in human is very, very important. The other is in Timor, we need to take that our agriculture productivity is still low. So it needs investment in that. Coming to the solution, there are a lot of things to say, but I would limit that to make it stronger, that investment in education is the key, and it has been proven. It is the driving force of change. With that, I would end my contribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Guta. Could we have the three speakers come to the chairs at the front? We have about half an hour for questions. So I'll take the questions a few at a time, but just to summarize a little bit, I think what we heard from all the speakers was that in all three countries, you definitely see a change in the aid landscape to one that's less aid dependent. And also you see a slight shift in the makeup of aid, so moving more towards less grant funding and more concessional lending. Also, you see the increase in all three cases of Chinese assistance. And even though Timor-Leste, for example, is the change in the landscape is largely due to the petroleum fund. China is now the sixth largest provider in Timor-Leste. At the same time, I think all three speakers expressed there's still lingering frustration and new frustrations with traditional donors. And there still remains issues around coordination and speed with which development assistance is administered. So with that, I'll take questions. Is there mics? There's mics. Okay, so I'll start here, one. And then second, Thien would be second, okay? And then I'll take one from over there. And then third in the back, and then the front, okay?
Name a collaboration from Princeton University and AIMU. My question is from all of the colleagues. I wonder how much of foreign aid goes through government budget and vis-a-vis off budget in terms of the percentage. And the second question is in terms of what are the pathways out of aid dependence in these kind of things.
The second question was, I had pointed to someone. Yes, yes, Dan.
Thank you very much to the presenters. Thank you for all fantastic presentations. Thank you very much. My questions go to the first two speakers from Cambodia and Laos. And my name is Thien Bo, I'm a Vietnamese researcher studying at the moment at the University of Queensland. My basic question is, who are the principal actors of delivery of implementing the development aid in Cambodia and Laos, given the rise of China's aid in these both countries as the now biggest donors? Because in term traditional donors, the principal actors of main delivery of those or implementers of the development aids are NGOs, local NGOs. Actually, even through the international NGOs. So local NGOs are the main vehicle for implementation. So is that different from China's case, when China is the biggest donors and who are the main delivering and implementing these implement aids in countries?
Thank you. Adrian Hewitt. I'd like to ask Mr. Nevis. Put my questions to Mr. Medis this time. He mentioned Timor-Leste now, mature country with 13 years of independence, and reaching out more to the international community on its own resources. I wonder if you'd like to comment on the creation, partly through the instigation of the finance minister of the group G7 Plus, so a new multilateral body. Governmental body, and would you recommend it? As I understand it, it's a grouping of states that have survived wars, basically. Would you recommend it to his neighbours then?
And one question in the front, and then we'll turn to the panel.
My name is Kim. I'm a Cambodian PhD student at the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. I have a question to the first two speakers, my Cambodian friend and love. The question is, do we have concerns about moving backward, for like moving backward in terms of sustainable development, for example, in terms of focusing purely on art development or physical development, but paying less attention on the soft, or for example, social justice, natural resources, and environmental protection? Given that the positive landscape of donor aid helps these two countries to graduate from less developed countries to low middle income countries, which means they are eligible to concessional loans. And given that there's an increasing availability of Chinese aid, we provide no or little conditions in terms of putting the government to follow sustainable development principles in terms of natural resources and environmental protection, for example.
Okay, who would like to start? Mr. Hang?
Okay, I will start off with the questions from the audience on the figure on aid reported on budget. I think in Cambodia, the latest figure we got from donors is that 79% of aid to the government is being deported. I think I hear this qualification. This is not budget support. The amount of aid that is budget support for Cambodia is relatively small. But we close to 80% of the total aid that has gone through the government sector is being reported on budget, and which is going through normal legislative process of budgeting. And on that, on every time, then I think the question is not on the table right now. The speaker also has asked whether we, given the ability of the government, given the sustainable rate of growth, we seen aid. I think this question, I think, needs to be answered in conjunction with the evolving nature of aid also. Now, probably aid is no more, it's not solely about resource transfer, but may include technology, knowledge, cooperation, and exchange. So it has become like not just an instrument for transferring resources from rich country to a poor country, but probably a medium for cooperation. And in a sense, it's not possible to answer. We may not need aid in the future.
Okay.
Who is the principal implementers of aid projects? I think you are right. For the case of traditional donors, it has been the case that the aid of projects are implemented by both state institutions and non-governmental organizations. But in the case of aid from China, here I'm speaking about major infrastructure projects that have been supported by China. It takes the government, that is the agency, principal agency responsible for implementing those projects. Like I briefly touched upon in my presentation, I think in this new aid landscape and the post-2015 environment, there's a need for having a coherent view about development in Cambodia. So before we may probably have paid a lot of focus to grow per se with at the expense of human development and at the expense of environment. But the agreement on the sustainable development goals globally and the changing context of the Cambodia itself necessitate thinking about what should constitute development for the country. You have high rises, you have high rises, you have highways, but does that constitute development when the health of the majority of the people is not has not improved, but you have 100% primary education involvement, but the dropout rate is still relatively high compared to other countries in the region. So this we need to have a balance and coherent view. And of course, the government has seen growing needs for resources to support infrastructure projects, to support other undertakings. But in no time, has the government neglected consideration about environment, about sustainability. Of course, no, we have applied different standards, but consideration towards sustainability and environment has always been one of the factors in receiving aid or loans from China.
Okay. Gutta?
I want to start with this. I think that question is a little bit political, but not in a physical good position to answer it. What I can tell you is that the process was under the investigation of the court. So one of the principles in the democracy is that non-interference. So that it is, when it is under the court, then other institutions shouldn't interfere the process. About the aid dependency in Russia, budget support. In Timor, since I don't know about the period before, around 2007, 2006, but between 2002 and up to 2005, there were budget support around 50%. That is direct budget support. But now, since during the last 5 years, zero budget support. This year, if you consider the loan as the part of the aid, then it would be 70 million that is planned to be in the budget support, which is around 2%? 70? Yeah. Of the total budget. Yeah, so that is. So, in terms of the aid dependency, also depending on what are you looking at, from the government side or from the whole economy side? If you look at the government side, it is not, I mean, if you include the total public expenditure between the development partners and the budget support, it is around 10-12% of the whole public expenditure. If you count only for the government direct support, it is 0%. So, and if you count on the whole economy, without asking where the money will be spent in Timor or not, then it is around 8-10% of the total economy. So, it's I will give you in 2012, there were UN mission in Timor was about to finish, to end. So there were public discussion, misunderstanding in the media, including foreign media, that withdrawal of the UN would mean that the economy of Timor-Leste would collapse. But in fact, at the time, the budget, UN activity, only provide around less than 10%. 12% of the total economy. And when the UN leave, even if I interviewed some businessmen on one of the baseline studies on the service sector in Timor, they say, no, the UN is better. Because UN presence is always associated with conflict and war. So the tourists will not come. So when UN leave, it is better for the business because then the mindset of UN presence with the, so. For Timor Leste, depending on which Russia are you using, but independence is it's a very low. Having said that, it doesn't mean that it is not important.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Gutta. Pape?
Okay, just for now, I'll just add to reading on about 7 or 8%. You asked that question. And in terms of the information for the Chinese project, all Chinese firms, Chinese people, in terms of concern about the sustainable growth, yes, we are working on the next 5-year plan. Sustainable growth is one of the pillars that we are sort of objective for the 5-year plan, and seeing an issue that not only donors raise, but government officials and provincial governments also raise sustainable growth as well. So our new 5-year plan is not going to be economic growth.
Thank you. Okay, I'll take one more round of three short questions, if there are. One from this side, yes, one there, and one from there. in the back, and anyone from over here? Okay. I'll take those two. Okay.
Hi, my name is Sharon Lewis. I'm from the Australian Public Service Commission, and my question is for Mr. Chow. One of the points that you had on your slides was that aid has worsened governance, and I think each of the speakers have made a couple of points in relation to that. But I just wondered if you could expand on why you said that and what was behind that. And what are the sort of top three things that you would suggest that we would do differently as a way of improving that?
Okay, good question. The woman in the back.
Yeah, I think my question is the same. I'm Jo Hall, private consultant. I wanted to ask what advice you would give to the Australian aid program. If you were, you heard this morning that it's shrinking quite rapidly, it needs to reprioritise exactly what it's going to do. If you were able to advise, what would be your one or two pieces of advice?
Okay, Susan, in the front.
Thanks, Andrea, for picking me into the call. My question is for my good friend Guta from the President's office. Timor is definitely a unique case because you can say that only 10% of the budget is aid, and I think that's a very compelling statement to make. It's also the second most oil-dependent country in the world. So can you talk a little bit about, as an advisor to the President, what you advise the President in this current declining oil price? Because what struck me is you didn't refer to the private sector much in your discussion, and there's this discussion about the non-oil economy that needs to be developed in Timor-Leste as well. And then the other thing I think that's sort of form part of the three most common themes of oil dependency, private sector development, is the third one is education, which you did mention, and you thank the Australians for training the future leaders of Timor-Leste. But again, as an advisor to the President, what do you tell him? Why does Timor-Leste spend so little money on education at primary and secondary level, and how do you get to ANU without a proper primary and secondary education in Timor-Leste? So I'm just curious.
Okay, and the last there. Last question, one last question.
From University of Queensland. My question is to all of you, because I can see the Chinese aid is increasing in all countries. Does this aid is only grant aid, or it also includes concessional loans? And my second question is that, especially in Timor, is to say that country government has decided to move more towards concession loans and grants. I can understand the donors, from donors' point of view, the way they decide providing concessional aid, like income, based on the country income. But what is the government key reason deciding to move towards more from grants to concessional aid? Is it because sense of more responsibility and accountability increased, or less geopolitics involved?
Thanks for those questions. I'll change the order a little, give Guta a little time to think about that question from Susan. So we'll start with Pepe.
Advice to Ozzy or to Guta, working on a program. Well, two things. One, take long-term perspective, things going to change, not going to change really tomorrow, but it's going to be a long period. So I understand we have the young ambassador volunteers in the developing country who want to change that. So we have to think that change is not going to happen. Probably not my lifetime or your lifetime. So I think you remind yourself that. your work as a development professional can easier, you know, if you go to the country and say, I want to change it, I want to change it. So that's my first advice. Take it slow and see what happens. Particularly if you operate in one state country like that or one difficult situation, I mean, it's difficult. And second advice, I think, that I would give is use local expertise, team up with those reform-minded in the country, experts, or whatever, they're going to help you a lot. And they're going to make things happen when they know what they're doing. And they will facilitate whatever is going to happen. So I think that's two advice that I can give. Definitely more, but I think it's too deep and critical. And on the question on grant and loan, both, and then I think conventional loan is bigger than grant, and you asked why they accept grant and thing, and I wrote a thesis about that. One of the chapters is all about why it's attractive and whether government concerns about these conventional loans from China or from non-traditional donors. Yes, they do, they have concerns, they think about it, but they also welcome it. Aid from non-traditional donors, and then most of the reason sort of family is what we know as well, you know, because of the concrete outputs, and they need to give in the short period of time. In case of the government allows, and the party allows, they want to give output in the short period of time so that they can prove to the people that one party is working, you have this output, for example. And then also another reason that I'm not so much talked about in the literature, for example, is the equal partnership. So when the deal with Chinese officials, and if the Lao government officials feel that they are talking the same language in the deal, they're not that so small when I'm not saying traditional donors, when others come into Laos and say you have problems, you need to change this, you need to change that, and they we have problems and we need to restructure this, and then they don't like it. And then we try and believe they come as a friend, we come and learn from you, and you learn from us, and then we are all better. So I think that sort of wants to make this difference. And then, of course, they have concerns about concessional learnings, and because they have, in case of love, they have to land concessions, for example, some other issues. Yeah, but I don't know about it.
Thanks. Mr. Heng?
Okay, on the question of aid from China, I think most of aid that can be received from China is in the form of concessional loans and proportion. And why the government start up so easily to Chinese aid? I think first, it's because of the nature of our needs. So we need funds for infrastructure projects. In short, we need roads and bridges, which the original government, except Japan, has been reluctant to support. So China has been quick to clear into that. Like I said, of course, we have also taken into consideration environmental sustainability type also. Recently, Australia also has begun to support, to show interest in supporting infrastructure projects in Cambodia, partnering with the private sector in funding, in repairing a rail network in Cambodia. But the project, I think, has been put off for now. Because of the number of reasons. On the question of whether aid has worsened government in Cambodia, this is exactly from a study on the effect of aid and development in Cambodia, and it has been a credible study and has been widely accepted between the general public as well as academics in Cambodia. That the case of receiving aid have only worsened rather than strengthening good governance despite the objective of aid being supportive of good governance. Why is this so? I think there are a lot of reasons to this. Probably aid was not designed rightly in the first place, or political economy factors were too predominant to were too influential in diverting aid towards the intended objective. So a lot of factors are in play. And I would think that to improve governance, at least aid projects, I think aid projects or donors first need to work with and through systems, national systems. You need to work with and through national systems. And this morning I was in a kind of discussion about results of evaluations of Australian aid in the context of decentralization. I think the findings were interesting in that to be effective, aid should work through the local system. And of course, working with and through a national system can be time consuming and sometimes frustrating. But this is if the objective of aid is development, I think there's a need for balance in this. Second, aid should also focus on even capacity of the actors that man or that steer or that birth in those systems. This is important because I have seen a lot of projects funded by our donors haven't paid enough attention to persevering, development. And third, aid projects should also engage community, local people and community, a user group need to engage them to demand for good governance. We need to build, a project should help to build demand for good governance from the grassroots level. So I think these are what I can say, I can comment about the relationship between aid and good governance in Cambodia. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job.
I have a very tough questions. I will start from Isla. About the concession and about the demographic case. It was a kind of an issue at the time, why the demographic needs have around $50 billion sitting on the Federal Reserve Bank, and then it has to take money. It is an iron. So there was a discussion. I was very critical and I wrote several articles about the danger of taking the loans. But the issue in Timor-Leste is that there have been, government has spent a lot of money on the building infrastructure, but the capacity of the local contractors to build the road is so low. So the public are upset about it. We're upset about it. So in the one discussion that we had a big debate on Facebook. Tomorrow, Facebook is the very web people discuss from. It's a middle class. So it is better because then we just get the road. Better road, then we give the money to them and then we got the good road today, but tomorrow will be destroyed again. So people think that taking the concessional loan would help, especially in having a better road. So most of the concessional loan that is planned to take today 70 million, but they said would be used for the road only, because that is one of the big issues in Timor. So people, at least that is the rationale that I think public accepts for that. In terms of how to pay, it is a little bit hard, but if you read the debt service evaluation, tech analysis by the IMF, the rate, the risk of what people call it in the debt terms is the failure to debt, to pay debt is still low. So, but and also the 70 million is small. Well, the question from Susan, I know when you have someone who knows the country inside your building, the questions will be hard. It's some of these issues are very critical in Timor-Leste, but if I want to talk about it, it will be very, very long. But the private sector in Timor is one of the private sector in Timor is not a modern private sector. It depends on the public expenditure. Why is it like this? There are various reasons for it. But one we can complain that Timor-Leste in its history have never had an experience of living in a modern diversified economy. It was an agriculture subsistence economy, and but still until now. So when you move from that to a kind of modern economy, then you build a private sector that would largely depend on the private public sector expenditure. So, and then in terms of that, there are other problems, lack of financial resources, lack of managerial skills, and lack of long-term vision. So they invest in what can provide them return instantly. They haven't had any tradition to think of long-term investment. So, and in fact, some of the, I have to admit, the government's policy, fiscal policy, is also sometimes disrupt private sector investment in that. But to solve that, it's a very, because we have to see the tax regime in Timor-Leste, we have to see land law in Timor-Leste, we have to review the public, public fiscal policy. So there are a lot of issues in the regard, but it is an issue that people now are talking about the diversification, economic diversification. Before, in 2005, I was involved in the petroleum sector, petroleum revenue management. People didn't talk about it. At least the issue of economic diversification came up today. And I wrote, I think what I think is true. Whether president agrees or not, I see it is better for an advisor to say what the board doesn't want to hear. an economic, just to give you, Timor-Leste is one of the second most dependent oil dependent countries after South Sudan. The irony is, although it is the most oil dependent, it doesn't have much oil. So it is an irony for Timor-Leste. And or you can think in other ways that Timor-Leste is not dependent on oil not because it has so much oil, but because its non-oil economy was not developed. So even when the economy of the non-oil increased in certain level, but the economy of the oil surpassed the growth of the non-oil economy, of the oil economy, higher than oil economy. So in Timor-Leste economy, that it's hard to differentiate between public expenditure and non-oil economy, because the driving force for the non-oil economy is the public expenditure.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Guta. We have to break soon, yeah. So are you wrap up quickly if you can?
To wrap up with the advice to the Australian government.
No answer?
No, I think I said that one, two of them, just one of them about education. Mm-hmm. The other is, it would be, I mean, after all, they did have to put the virus because it was in public and also in the public health, special access to water. That is what Australian government.
Thanks. Thanks very much to the great questions and also to our speakers. Thanks to our speakers for their very frank answers. In summary, I just wanted to make one observation. It's interesting that we heard from Cambodia that governance has declined as a result of more aid. And what we heard in our dialogues, both in Cambodia and Timor-Leste, is that there's actually an oversubscription, or there's quite a heavy presence of traditional donors in the governance sector in terms of their aid support to both countries. So that's kind of an interesting paradox. But overall, I think given the changes in the development landscape and the aid financing in all three countries, what we do notice, and this is across the board, I think, in Asia, that development partners, partner countries welcome the change despite the challenges. And at least four countries in Asia, they very much see themselves in the driver's seat. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.